Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Jamie Ford, whose latest novel is Songs of Willow Frost. Jamie Ford is the author of an earlier novel, Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet. These two books take place in Seattle. I guess you're from Seattle.
I'm from Seattle, yeah.
And they involve the Chinese-American community. The first book involved a Chinese boy and his relationship with the internment of Japanese during World War II. This book goes a little bit further back into the Depression and even into the Roaring Twenties, and talks about the Chinese-American experience through the eyes of a young man and his mother. We learn all about the Chinese-American experience and what it was like, an area that is really not covered by many people ever.
A lot of Chinese-American authors, sometimes they're writing about life under Chairman Mao or something like that, but rather than that immigrant experience that I'm close to.
And you're close to it because your great-grandfather came over and changed his name to William Ford?
My great-grandfather was named Min Chung, came through Angel Island, ended up in Tonopah, Nevada, working for the Borax Mining Company. But yeah, his name was Min Chung, came over, and about 30 years later changed his name to William Ford, which we don't really know why. I mean, we think maybe it had to do with buying property, but it could have just been, you know, someone coming to this country today and choosing the name Clint Eastwood or, you know, Chuck Norris. You know, it's a red-blooded American name.
This particular book, Songs of Willow Frost, the origin of the book, was it some research that you discovered while working on the previous novel?
It began with research I had begun regarding hotel. I was really interested in the Depression in Seattle, the Depression era, Prohibition. I mean, there's a lot of cool things going on there. But that was when my grandparents met. My Chinese grandparents met at a backroom gambling parlor called the Wami Club. And my grandfather was a blackjack dealer, and my grandmother was the coat check girl. And, you know, it was this hub in the community where before Vegas, you know, if you wanted booze and live music and gambling and other kinds of salacious fun, you went to places like Chinatown.
And that started the ball rolling. You went to a museum called the Wing Luke Museum.
Yeah. The Wing Luke Museum's awesome. It's in Chinatown. Great cultural museum. The cool thing now is I'm actually a novelist, and so I have a little credibility. Before, when I'm researching, I'm just like this crazy aspiring writer, but now I get to go into the archives and put on those white gloves and step through the door like Howard Carter stepping into King Tut's tomb. And there was a Cantonese opera star named Ping Chow who donated all of his costumes, all of his headpieces and scripts, 7 trunks full of stuff, to the Wing Luke, and I was able to go and get my hands on that stuff, and that led to the story of Chinese opera, to early film in Seattle, the character of Willow Frost herself.
And how did you come across the Sacred Heart Orphanage and put those pieces together?
I was always fascinated by the ethnic film stars of the time, you know, Anime Wong and Stephen Fetchett, these people that were caricatures of their culture. And I started there, but then as I'm researching the time period, I read about the Sacred Heart Orphanage, a real place in North Seattle. And what was startling to me as a researcher was that most of the orphans there had living parents, that during the Depression, if you couldn't afford to take care of your kids, you just consign them to the sisters and hope to come back one day, which is especially heartbreaking. If you've lost your parents as a child, that's one thing. But to never know why you were left behind or if they're coming back and you can't be adopted because they might be coming back for you, you never get that closure. And even the great author of the West, Wallace Stegner, and his brother spent 9 months at Sacred Heart during the Depression. And so it connected these two imaginary friends, the orphan and the movie star, basically tapped me on the shoulder and said, you know, we're related. And that's when the story, the whole arc of the story came into being.
At that point, it suddenly occurred to you, this is mother and son, and then you work back from there?
Yeah. I mean, I was closer to my mom, who I lost many years ago, closer to her than, you know, just about anybody in the world, short of my wife, really. I really felt for my mom and my Chinese grandmother because they had cataclysmic upbringings, had a rough go of it, had rough childhoods, the two of them. When you're a woman, you're marginalized. If you're a woman growing up in the Depression and you're Chinese American and perhaps you have a child out of wedlock, I mean, you're really on the margins of polite society. And so the book really is a nod to the things that they went through.
At that point, Jamie Ford, you begin doing your research, and that's when you discover really how marginalized they actually were.
Oh, man. Yeah. My grandmother had my dad in, I guess, 1928, was not married, and I knew she had it rough. I didn't realize how rough until I researched the time period and saw that, you know, the men had all the rights, the fathers had all the rights. Women with children out of wedlock were seen as less than moral, risked having their children taken away from them. Obviously, if they had a kid out of wedlock, then, you know, they're not capable of raising a moral child into adulthood. And there were no social safety nets to help them along the way. And so it was a hard scrabble existence, one that I wouldn't really wish upon anybody, but I'm proud of who they were and how they came through it.
You said your grandmother wasn't married. Was her situation similar to Lou Song's?
Was. Not as tragic, perhaps, as Lou Song's, but definitely in the same neighborhood. What do I know? I mean, there are stories. It's funny. Like most families, there are things you just don't ask. You find out about those things years later. Everyone has familial skeletons in their family closets. I certainly do.
So this was your father's mother?
Yeah.
So she raised him as a single parent during that period of the Depression.
She did. Fortunately, a couple years later, a few years later, she met another man, James Ng, who they married, and that was who raised my dad. And that's who I knew in Seattle as a grandfather. And that's who she met at the WAMI Club. He was a blackjack dealer.
I was struck by the fact that Chinese women who were single were not allowed in hospitals to have babies.
Yeah. It was another time, for sure. I mean, the social conventions were a little different. Even in a place, I mean, this is not Birmingham, Alabama. This is Seattle, Washington. But, you know, there was a famous restaurateur and activist named Ruby Chow, who was born on the docks. She would later run a restaurant and give Bruce Lee his first job. But like Ruby, my own mother, some of her first children were not born in the hospital. My mom was Caucasian, and it wasn't because of racism. It was because of her socioeconomic status. She just couldn't afford it. My Caucasian mother grew up in the South, and we forget that we're really not that far removed from a pretty strict class society where if you didn't have an economic means, you really were in a corner.
Somewhere along the line, she winds up being an extra with the H.C. Weaver Studio, which you wrote in some accompanying literature was the third largest Hollywood studio, and it was located in Seattle. They made three movies, Now Lost. How did you find out about them?
The public library. I called the Seattle Film Office, and I asked them for the earliest movie shot in Seattle. They said Tugboat Annie, which was filmed in 1933. But I had read in some old newspaper clippings of a film cruise being on Mount Rainier around 1918, so I knew there was other stuff going on. I finally stumbled upon an archive that had the photo record of the H.C. Weaver Studios, which was the third largest film studio in America, for this brief, shining sliver of cinematic time. They were based in Tacoma, Washington. The studio produced silent films that really got lost in the wake of the talkies, and then the studio burned to the ground a few years later. So it's probably this, you know, quiet suburb in Tacoma. No one remembers it. But they produced a movie called Eyes of the Totem, which was shot in Tacoma, Washington at this famous old hotel. They redesigned, you know, that they came in and turned the hotel into a Chinese cabaret, and that's the set that appears in the book.
There are some actors, of course, that I recognize and have seen. I was a fan of pre-code movies for a while, so I was seeing a lot of these really strange films from the early 30s. But there's a lot of other names I don't know. Were they all real?
When I had the opportunity in the book, I used the real actors and actresses. And so I refer to to step and fetch it, and Sesue Hayakawa, who's a famous Japanese film star right. of the silent era.
Those are the best known names. Were the other ones names you made up, or did you find their names in listings for the Weaver production studio?
The ones related to the Weaver studio were the actual names. Rhonda Hawley. I'm probably butchering these names. The only performer that I injected that I made up was, and he's only in there for a few pages, was Ozza Berger. I mean, he's a stand-up comic, but I've met some stand-up comics in real life, and they're always the funniest guys on stage and the saddest guys off stage. And this is a character that emotes that.
Step and Fetch It, that's Lincoln Perry?
Lincoln Perry, yeah.
Brilliant man, then.
Yeah, you know, I mean, back then, he was a huge star. He worked within the margins that he was allowed. You know, he's a tragic figure, because later he's seen as someone that embodied the stereotype and, you know, became a pariah in his later years. It's hard. It's hard to form fit a modern sensibility on someone that's just trying to make a living in another time period.
William, the young man who spends part of the book at the orphanage, has a best friend, a beautiful blind girl. Where did she come from?
A couple things. One was the Sacred Heart Orphanage, you know, it was a real place. It's like a private school now in Seattle. But Mother Cabrini, who was later canonized as a saint, if you're into saints, she was credited with two miracles, and one was restoring the sight of a blind girl at Sacred Heart. That's kind of where I injected that. But it was also, I was more interested in how the girl lost her sight. She wasn't born blind. Like Charlotte in the book, she was blinded at birth. She was born, and they put silver nitrate in the baby's eyes just to keep the kids from contracting gonorrhea or syphilis from the mother. You know, it's kind of the seedy truth of it. But they put too much in. They blinded her. I mean, what a horrible thing to happen. It's like tragedy upon tragedy. So that's really where the character of Charlotte comes about. She's almost William's instigator, his conscience, someone that's kind of poking him in the side, encouraging him to do things he might not otherwise do.
So in that sense, she plays a role in furthering the plot.
Yeah, I mean, she's Jiminy Cricket to his Pinocchio.
Jamie Ford, as you're doing your research, there may have been many things that have been shocking and surprising you. For instance, that citizens, Asian Chinese citizens who marry non-citizens lose their citizenship.
Yeah, after the laws restricting Chinese labor, the Chinese Exclusion Act, there were pretty severe consequences. I mean, they were seen as competing labor pool. They were labor unions that didn't want Chinese workers around. I mean, once we finished building the railroads, you know, what do you do with these thousands of workers and more that were coming in every day? And so if you were Chinese American, Chinese born here, and you married a Chinese citizen, you would lose your citizenship and have to leave.
For you, what was the most surprising thing you discovered?
I was enamored with a studio that no one had ever heard of, no one remembers, in Tacoma. Really, the most surprising thing for me was truly the concept of the orphanages. You know, when I think of orphans, I think of Oliver Twist or Little Orphan Annie. I think of someone that is this happy orphan struggling to survive, no parents, but the reality is different. You know, I did a book event, and a woman drove 127 miles to come to my event. She waited in line to the very end, and then she came up to me and said, "Hi, my name's Margaret. I grew up in the Sacred Heart Orphanage." And her story was wildly tragic. I mean, there's drama in the book, but man, what a story this woman has of leaving her mother and her siblings being sent to the orphanage, and she saw her mother one time who returned to bring her a winter coat, and there's other aspects that are incredible. And sometimes I think as a researcher and just as a reader, we like to find the truth in fiction, even if the truth is startling.
You're listening to an interview with Jamie Ford, whose latest novel is Songs of Willow Frost. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves. The political subtext of Songs of Willow Frost, you know, if people want to talk, not necessarily in Berkeley or people listening to non-commercial radio now, but people want to talk about eliminating the social safety net. What you wind up with are Hoovervilles.
Yeah. I mean, actually, you know, that was another interesting thing. When I was doing the research was just the commonality between the political landscape today. Everything that's going on now is really such an echo of what was going on before the New Deal, where everyone was so afraid of all the isms, you know, the socialism, fascism, communism, isolationism, Trotskyism, and how people thought the New Deal was going to bankrupt the nation. It was going to remove the desire of the working class to actually work, when in fact it saved the country.
They talk now about, oh, the good old days when government stayed out of people's lives, and yet the moral role of government taking children away from their parents.
Yeah. I mean, it has its roots in the orphan trains in the late 1800s, 1860s, all the way up to the 20s, where truant officers had a heavier hand in how people were perceived as parents. Single mothers would have to have a truant officer come by, and if your kid wasn't going to school, if your kid wasn't attending Sunday school, you would not be eligible for, you know, perhaps a mother's pension. You might lose your child, have your kids taken away and put in an orphanage because you were seen as unfit to raise a kid who was able to deal with polite society.
Jamie Ford, how big was Seattle's Chinatown at the time in relation to the whole city? I mean, are we talking about a very small population where everybody knows each other, or was it bigger than that?
Seattle's Chinatown today is pretty small, but it was much bigger in the 40s. You know, its heyday probably in the 40s and the 30s. It was a small community, and it wasn't just Chinese. It was Japanese, African-Americans, Koreans, Filipinos, even Italian-Americans, Jewish-Americans. Interesting. I love going back and seeing the tapestry of these neighborhoods, because whether it was actual laws on the books or it was just the social prejudice of the time of not renting an apartment or not selling a home or a business or someone who wasn't Caucasian, you ended up with all of these diverse ethnicities living together, one on top of another. And they're all estranged together. You know, they're all the outliers together, which I think is really interesting to see. That's the actual melting pot we all talk about in one place.
Did they communicate much with each other, or were they pretty much just separate entities within this larger community?
You know, I think the second generation communicated with everyone else. I think that the first generation hadn't quite assimilated, maybe didn't speak the language, remained a bachelor society of workers that hung out with one another. But that next generation definitely intermingled. I mean, in my family, my dad's generation, you know, my dad married a Caucasian woman and his cousin married a Japanese woman, and definitely marrying outside of their social circles. But that first generation, not exactly golfing buddies.
While Lu Song spoke English, a lot of the women and the men who came over did not, right?
Yeah, Lu Song stuck. She's American-born. Her parents were mavericks working in Cantonese operas. And she's too American. She's too tall. She's not seen as a suitable candidate for marriage within the Chinese community there. But then she's Chinese. And like what Anna May Wong herself ran into, she moves to Hollywood. She's dating these Caucasian producers and directors. She's having these love affairs, but she could never marry them because there were miscegenation laws on the books forbidding. She couldn't get a marriage license.
The other part is that the people who worked in theater in those days, Cantonese opera, as well as traditional theater and film, were looked down upon.
Yeah, definitely, especially in the Chinese-American community.
Why do you think that is?
I run into this today. You know, I'm a writer, and people, you know, I tell people I'm a writer, and they look at me like, you know, they may not know that I make my living as a writer. They think it's a dalliance, it's a hobby, it's a wistful dream. Why can't you have some sort of real job like an accountant or a lawyer or something like that? I think a lot of that was typified back then. It was seen as on the fringe of what was acceptable. It was entertainment. It wasn't a serious vocation. It was for dreamers and artists. People have always condemned artists in certain circles, but especially for Lu Song, because she's a woman. And in traditional Chinese theater, the female roles are played by men, and women that hung around the theater were seen as consorts and prostitutes. And I mean, in addition to a society that doesn't really view women as having any value outside of the home.
she also works as a song plugger, which I knew about from having read about what was happening in Tin Pan Alley way back when.
Tin Pan Alley, yeah.
She would sing songs in order to lure customers in to buy pianos in the days before radio.
It was a real gig. You know, if you had a voice, you could sing outside of the music store. They'd pay you per page of sheet music sold, have someone inside playing or have a player piano or a pianola playing the song. You know, this is just before radio, certainly before television. If you wanted to hear music before you bought it, you had to hear it live.
How did you find out about and decide to make her a song plugger?
Somewhere along the lines, I was researching, who was it? I want to say Ella Fitzgerald or Bessie Smith or one of the great jazz blues greats that actually worked as a song plugger in her teens, like as a 14-year-old, on the street selling sheet music by the page. And that's where the first idea came to me.
Jamie Ford, you mentioned before how a lot of people in, say, the Asian American community look down upon you for writing entertainment. Do you think that might be one of the reasons why for a long time there might not have been as many Asian American writers as there should have been? Or do you think it's something else?
Definitely. And I don't know the real taproot of that culturally. It may go back to mainland China, where if you were a bright, precocious kid, then you might have been tapped to move to one of the more intellectual cities and be groomed as a scholar. Otherwise, you know, you were just a petty laborer like everyone else. And there really was no room for a traveling entertainer. It was almost seen as on the same level as a snake oil salesman or a huckster. Maybe that type of attitude towards the arts was transplanted to the immigrant population. And I'm not sure, but I you know, it is that joke of the high expectation Asian father, where, you know, you become a doctor and become, you know, a point guard for the New York Knicks, and then only then will I call you my son, that kind of stuff.
Jamie Ford, 7 years after the book ends, William is still assumed in Seattle, might be in Hollywood, but we assume he's in Seattle, and the Japanese internment comes up. How did that affect Chinese Americans for most people who couldn't tell the difference in appearance between the Japanese and the Chinese?
That was the impetus for my first novel. Was my dad was a teenager during World War II. After Pearl Harbor, he's going to public school and the white kids are throwing rocks at him. It split the community. You know, there's one generation that holds a lot of cultural baggage going back to conflicts in occupied China. Then there's another generation that's going to school together, playing kick the can together, that doesn't understand what the big deal is. Again, that's a rift you always have, I think, between generations of assimilation.
Jamie Ford, what prompted you to become a writer? You said at one point that when you wrote your parents' eulogies, but your mom died only 10 years ago.
My background is in art and design, so I was always more of a visual artist. So I was one of those kids that always had a sketchbook, but I was always also writing really terrible poetry in my sketchbook. And I wanted to be a writer. My mom wanted me to be a writer. I was making my living in the visual arts as a graphic designer, art director. And when you do that, you're basically pimping your creative soul by the hour. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. They pay you well for your soul. But I started writing on the side just so I had this creative sandbox to call my own. And I really enjoyed the process of writing. The problem was I didn't have anything to write about. I really hadn't been kicked around by life enough. And it wasn't until I lost both my parents that suddenly I had this well of stuff to draw upon, to add real emotion to the stories that I want to tell. And suddenly my stories had traction. But also there's authors that have inspired me. I mean, I'm a huge Harlan Ellison fan. I mean, he was a guy that inspired me as a kid and still inspires me as an adult. After I had a measure of success with the first book, I contacted Harlan. I bought his first typewriter.
When you decided you were going to start writing, and you just suddenly thought, okay, this was my father's past, I'm going to go back and write about World War II.
You know, before Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, I wrote this other weird literary novel that was contemporary. And I was writing what I thought I was supposed to write, and it just wasn't me. My mom and dad died about 18 months apart. After my dad died, I went to this writer's conference workshop, and they had us write something. And I'd been splashing around in the time period of my dad's childhood. And while I was there, I wrote this story. It was the first time I had ever written anything with Asian American characters. And I had never done that before because I didn't think anybody cared. And at that point, I didn't care either. I'm going to write what I want to write. As Harlan Ellison says, you should write for the wisest, wittiest, most intelligent audience in the world. You should write for yourself. And so in an indulgent moment, I wrote this 30-page short story with the characters of Henry and Keiko and the button that reads, I am Chinese, which is something that my dad wore to keep kids from throwing rocks at him after Pearl Harbor. And people liked it. And it was a validation of, for me, that maybe I could write these things that I wanted to write. And maybe someone else would enjoy reading it.
So you finished the book and sent it out to an agent? How'd you find an agent?
I finished Hotel. I sent it out. I queried a bunch of agents. And much to my surprise, people were interested, which was a shocker to me because I just wanted to, my bar for success was pretty low. Just to have someone buy the book, enjoy it, that didn't share my same last name, you know, that kind of thing. Landed an agent, Kristen Nelson, out of Denver. Had some other offers from New York agents, but I really clicked with Kristen, and, you know, the rest is kind of history.
Jamie Ford, this took 4 years to write, Songs of Willow Frost.
I always look askew at authors when they say, this book took 7 years. And I'm thinking, did it really take 7 years? How many starts and stops and finishes? Songs of Willow Frost probably took the same amount of time as Hotel, which is about a year. But it took me a year or two to get there. And I started some other ideas, and I would be 150 pages into another novel. But once I found this story, it felt right. It was like falling in love.
150 pages into another novel. In other words, there's this other thing in your computer that's 150 pages long now?
It's 450 pages long. Yeah, it kept growing and growing. You know, it took on its own life like Frankenstein. And eventually I had to put it in a medically induced coma and walk away from it. My editor was interested and I could have published it, but it just didn't feel like the right follow-up. And I think it's something I'll revisit, you know, 10 years from now.
What's the subject matter?
The reason it didn't feel like a good follow-up for me was it was another World War II-based novel, and it was based in Japan. It was about a repatriated Japanese-American who is conscripted into the Japanese military, and a kid who's more of a poetic heart. And it's a bit of the atrocities that Japan committed on its own population. And we think of Japan doing some terrible things in China, but Imperial Japan did some terrible things to its own people. You know, I went to Japan. I did research for it. Interviewed a lot of people. It was an interesting book, but I started it before Hotel was published, and then suddenly Hotel took off. And suddenly I didn't really want to follow it up with another World War II story. I wanted to jump to another time period because suddenly people were looking and caring, which I didn't anticipate at all. So I dabbled with that, and I also dabbled with the characters of Lu Song and William. I took the first chapter of that, and I read it at a gala fundraiser in Seattle for Humanities Washington, and everyone really liked it, and that was when it really clicked that was probably the next story.
In all of your books, these two and the one unpublished one, since it's historical, it's about trying to get details right. I mean, for instance, in Songs of Willow Frost, they go to movies, they see movies in the theater. You know, there were a couple of times when I was kind of shaking my head and wondering, is this accurate or not? How accurate did you try to be, or did you sometimes just fudge? Or
I try to be 98.6% accurate. When I have the opportunity to be accurate, I do try to be accurate. So if I mention a movie in this time period or a song in this time period, And I also have a copy editor who catches me. So sometimes I'll just make something up, like, you know, William will get on a number 17 bus and my copy editor will find an old bus schedule and say, no, it wasn't the number 17. It was actually the number 37 or something like that. Occasionally I let things go, but it's nothing that's germane to the whole story. Like in Hotel, there's a metaphorical reference to Casper the Friendly Ghost, and this is 1942, and I think technically Casper wasn't invented till 43, and I'm thinking, you know, who's going to care?
So, good luck with that one.
I like my metaphor. I'm going to keep it. And lo and behold, yeah, there's someone who's, you know, den is decked out with Casper memorabilia who emails me frantically correcting me, and, you know, you got to live with that. Yeah, you get those people that they don't appreciate the 99%. They just want to quibble the one. I'm all about verisimilitude. Let's get the spirit of the book. And if there's a couple little things that have a drift to them, that's okay.
In the afterword, you mention a mystery novel by Gypsy Rose Lee, and we can call it the "by" in quotes because who knows if she actually wrote it. What research did you do that involved using that novel sufficiently to put it in your book?
Yeah. The G-String Murders, or I think that's what it was called, by Gypsy Rose Lee. I liked it because it was written right around that time period, and I read certain books like that just to jot down vernacular, or what things cost, or what a cup of coffee cost. In that book, they referred to the candy counter as the candy butcher, because they have these big things of chocolate and fudge and taffy, and they slice off a chunk. And so that kind of terminology, it's hard to come by unless you read a memoir or something from the time period, because you don't tend to read that. You get that vernacular in a nonfiction book, which tends to be more as it's translated through a modern lens.
Well, you could also watch some of those pre-codes as well.
Totally.
I have.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, I love old movies like that.
Jamie Ford, you mentioned this huge novel that you've been working on. Is that going to be your next book, or are you working on something else?
No, the next book actually is another Seattle book. I have at least one more Seattle book in me, and this one is set between the two World's Fairs. The first one was 1909, and then there was the one in 62. So it actually goes from 1909 to about 1959. And at that first World's Fair, they have themed days, and so they, like on an agricultural day, they would raffle off a bushel of wheat, and they raffled something off every day. You know, they raffle off a cow. And one day they actually raffled off a child who was donated by the Washington Receiving's Home, and no one knows what happened to this kid. And so I've taken it upon myself to make up this boy's life story, mixing it in with a lot of the other interesting cultural things that are going on in Seattle, you know, circa 1915.
Have you had any interest from Hollywood on either of these first two books?
A lot of interest on Hotel. It's like selling your baby to the circus. Hollywood is so strange. And so I haven't quite found the right adoptive home. Every month there's a query. And I've been told by my film agent that Songs of Willow Frost actually has a better shot because the character of Willow Frost is a grown-up. And so there's a role for an adult actress. The problem is, my characters are so young, and they're Asian, and there isn't a name character. And so they tend to want to make Henry white. You know, Hollywood is run by accountants, and so they just, it's a story problem for them to solve rather than the integrity of the book or the story itself. That's the one thing I'm not willing to compromise on.
You've been listening to an interview with Jamie Ford, whose latest novel is Songs of Willow Frost. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.